In Germany, the Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz Prizes recognise outstanding contributions to science. This year, an economist is one of the winners. We talk to her about working hours, where our political views come from, and what we've learned from German reunification. Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of interviews with the world's leading economists. At the Centre for Economic Policy Research, we were delighted to hear that Nicola Fuchs-Schundeln of Goethe University Frankfurt, who's one of our fellows, is a 2018 winner of the Leibniz Prize. The prize includes a large cash award to fund her future work. So we called Nicola at work to ask about the research agenda that's made her a winner and what she's going to do with the prize.
Many economists listening to this might be thinking, I like the sound of this Leibniz Prize. How do I win one? So how did you become a winner?
I mean, first of all, you have to do research in Germany. So you don't have to be German, but you have to be located in Germany. And the Leibniz Prize is the most important scientific research prize in Germany. It's awarded annually by the German Research Foundation to 10 researchers across all different fields. So from the natural sciences to the social sciences to the humanities. And it's not a grant, it's a prize. So you don't put in an application, you have to be nominated, and the university presidents are among the ones who can nominate researchers from their university. And it's given in recognition of previous work and comes with prize money that is to be used for future research. And as an economist, I have to say the chances are not too high in the more than 30 years of the history of the prize. I'm only the sixth economist to win it.
So were you surprised to win it then?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I mean, it's a great honor and it's not something that one can count on.
It's quite a large cash prize. Do you know what you're going to use the money for yet?
Yeah, not exactly. So it comes with significant prize money of 2.5 million euros that can be spent over 7 years, though. So I have some time to spend it. And I'm free to use it for all kind of research. So in my case, as you see, I do a lot of research involving data work, sometimes also purchasing data, combining data sets, a lot of empirical and nitty-gritty work. So I think most of the prize money will be used for support of this kind of work.
You can't keep any of the money for yourself.
No.
The prize is given in recognition of previous outstanding scientific work, so we should look more deeply at that work. As you said, your research is characterized by this nitty-gritty accounting process, often on large empirical data sets. Most recently, you've been comparing the hours that people work.
Yes, so over the last 4 or 5 years, I mostly worked on differences in hours worked across countries. And if I say across countries, in one project, we really look across all countries of the world income distribution. So from the very poorest ones to the richest ones. And the basic, very basic question we are asking there is, how do hours worked of people in poor countries actually compare to the hours that we work in richer countries? And you might be surprised, but we didn't know the answer of that, because the usual data we as economists use on hours worked per person comes from the OECD, which naturally only covers OECD countries. So what we did is we said the only data source available to answer the question are really micro data sets from the different individual countries. So we went across all countries of the world income distribution and searched for micro data sets that cover questions on hours worked in these respective countries. So we didn't go into the fields ourselves to collect the data, because we wanted a large nationally representative survey. So this is a very expensive endeavor. But we really went country by country and searched for available data sets. And in the end, we managed to get data from 80 different countries. And the biggest issue that if you have micro data sets from different countries, is whether these data are really comparable across countries. So we make sure that the question on hours worked are asked in a very similar way, and also that all of these surveys ask people over the entire year of how many hours they work. Because especially in very poor countries that are often agricultural, you have a lot of seasonal patterns in hours worked. And what we find then when we look at all these countries is that if you look at countries that belong to the poor third of the world income distribution, adults there work on average 29 hours per week, while an average adult and countries belonging to the richest third of the world income distribution works only 19 hours a week. So there is a difference of 10 hours or 50% that people in poor countries work more than people in rich countries. So it's a really significant difference.
And that leads us, I understand, to revise what we know about productivity.
Exactly. So as a macroeconomist, I care about these differences first because of the measurement of labor productivity. So if you want to understand how productive countries are, we look at labor productivity, and that is typically measured as GDP per worker. So now that we have actual data on hours worked, we can go one step deeper, not only ask how different are GDPs per worker, but how different is GDP per actual hours worked. And there we find that the differences between poor and rich countries increase by 20% if we take these differences in hours into account. And another important application comes for welfare differences, because also for welfare hours worked matter a lot. So the first thing we look at if we analyze welfare is consumptions, but another factor that influences welfare is leisure time. Maybe people in poor countries could have had more leisure than people in rich countries, so then they would be poor in consumption terms, but richer in leisure terms. But we actually find the opposite. So we find that people in poor countries are not only consumption poor, but they are also leisure poor.
Now, I see you've also applied a similarly careful approach to the questions of whether Europeans work less than Americans.
Yeah, so in one project, we zoom in now on the richer countries and look at the US versus Europe. And again, what we do in contrast to the previous research is that we use micro data sets to look at these differences. So first, we find that on aggregate, Europeans work around 14% less hours than US Americans. And that's something that is already known based on OECD data. But what is interesting now is that we can do a decomposition of these differences. So we can really ask what components are important for these differences. And what we find there is that around 1/3 to 1/2 of the lower hours in Europe just come from fewer weeks worked. So 1/3 to 1/2 is really due to the fact that Americans have less vacation time. And another 1/3 to 1/2 can be explained by the on average higher share of low educated people in Europe than in the US. So within each country, within each single European country, also within the US, we see that employment rates increase a lot by education. So highly educated people have around a 30 percentage points higher employment rate than low educated people. So now by the simple fact that you have more high educated people in the US than in many European countries, especially in Eastern or Southern Europe, that explains another 1/3 to 1/2 of the difference. But there is actually a remainder, because then we see striking differences between the different European regions. So in Scandinavia and Western Europe, the employment rate is on average higher than in the US, but hours per worker, weekly hours worked in a typical work week, are lower. And in Southern Europe and Eastern Europe, it's the other way around. So their employment rates are lower than in the US, but people who work, they work on average longer hours.
Finally, the difference in the working hours of married men and married women. Again, this detailed approach created some unexpected insights, didn't it?
Yes. So there, we zoomed in further, now looking at only the population aged 25 to 54, because these are the ones where you typically think they participate in the labor market. And we asked, I mean, who are the groups that show the largest differences across countries? And there, what is really striking is that the married women stand out much more than married men or than single men and single women. And also, in countries where married men tend to work a lot, their single men and single women also tend to work a lot. So their behavior is often very similar. But married women, they really stand out. They seem to behave completely differently. So we were asking, what drives this behavior? And one hypothesis we were following is that it could have to do with taxation. That is because the macro literature previously has found that taxation is an important driver of hours worked. And what we find here is that indeed taxation helps to explain these differences in the labor supply of married women, but one has to look beyond the average tax rate at the tax treatment of married couples. So that means as to whether married couples are taxed jointly or separately. One could look, for example, at the US, Sweden, and Germany. So married men in Germany and Sweden work around 15% lower hours than married men in the US. And this is in line with higher average tax rate in Sweden or Germany than in the US. But then if you look at married women, you find that Swedish married women work almost as many hours as US married women, but German married women work 34% fewer hours. So this is surprising if you think of taxation. But then you have to take into account that in the US and in Germany, you have a system of joint taxation of married couples. In Sweden, you have a system of separate taxation. So let me explain how a system of joint taxation works. So what happens in Germany is that if you have a couple, for example, where the wife doesn't work, but the husband works and earns, let's say, 80,000 euros, then this couple is taxed as if both would earn 40,000 euros. So for the couple, that means that they are better off financially than if they were taxed separately. Because of the progressivity, the overall tax burden is lower if both are taxed at 40,000 euros than if one is taxed at 80,000 euros and the other person is not taxed because she does not work. But from the individual perspective, it also means that the marginal tax rate for both now is as if they would already earn 40,000 euros. So if the woman starts working, she's right away taxed with a very high marginal tax rate. So that discourages her from working and from working long hours. While Sweden has a system of separate taxation. And if you calculate the marginal tax rate, if a woman in a couple where the husband earns the average earnings goes from not working to working the average hours of married women, then this tax rate is around 30% in Sweden and the US, but it's 50% in Germany. So in Sweden, these 30% are a result of a high average tax rate and separate taxation. In the US, they are the result of a lower average tax rate, but joint taxation. And in Germany, you have both. You have joint taxation, high progressivity, and a high average tax rate. So this really discourages women, married women, from working.
You've also done research into whether political preferences are endogenous. What inspired this?
Well, this inspired the observation from living in Europe and in the US. So I grew up in Germany. I live in Germany now, but I studied and worked for 10 years in the US. The systems of these groups of countries are quite different. So in the US, basically the system points more to the self-reliance of people, while in Europe there is more social insurance built into the economic systems. And if you look at surveys, then these systems really reflect what people in the different countries prefer to have. So the question for me as a researcher is really what was there first? So is it just that people have different preferences, maybe because of the US settlers were more advantageous? Or is it that living in a certain system makes us used to the system so that after some time we think that this is a good system? So as economists, we typically think of preferences as being exogenous, so there would be no feedback from the system to the preferences. But I think if you talk to psychologists or so, they would say that it's very likely that this feedback exists. So it's very hard to say what was there first, the preferences or the system. It's a little bit like the egg and the chicken problem. Unless you get some episode where there is a shock to the system or to the preferences. And what I use there in order to analyze this question is a German separation and reunification. So the German separation after Second World War meant that you took one population was basically broken into two different groups and then for 45 years lived under a completely different system. Where the East-West border ended up, that was largely by coincidence. So it was where the troops were standing at the end of the Second World War. So one can think here of the system as being exogenously imposed on East and West Germans. So now they live in this different system for 45 years, and what we then analyze is that after reunification, do their preferences reflect this experience of living in the different systems? And what we find looking at survey evidence is that even after reunification, East Germans are much more in favor of state intervention and the state taking care of vulnerable groups like families or sick people, older people, and so on, than West Germans think. And also after reunification, the longer East Germans live in this new system, the more their preferences converge to the ones of West Germans.
At the time that you published the paper, you speculated that it would take between 20 and 40 years for the difference in preferences between East Germans and West Germans to disappear. We're about three quarters of the way through that. Has your prediction come true?
That's a very interesting question. I think if you just, as a non-scientific answer, if you look around you, you find that convergence is still ongoing, but it's not entirely there. So there are still differences between East and West. But as a scientist, I want to give you a scientific answer. And fortunately, I could convince the German Socioeconomic Panel, which is a survey that I used for this study, to include the question on preferences for state intervention again in the survey just last year. So the data is not out yet, but in a few months it will be out there, and then I can really analyze what happened now over this additional decade. Do we see convergence in these preferences or not?
The other question of political preferences that you've recently been involved with is whether the experience of living in a democracy causes support for democracy. The question of causality in this is quite difficult to establish, isn't it?
Exactly. So here again, one clearly sees the correlation. So here we use data from the World Values Survey, which asked people about their support of democracy. And you see that generally more people answer that they support democracy in countries that are democratic than in countries that are not democratic. But again, the question is, are these countries democratic because people support democracy, or is it the other way around? Is it also that living under democracy shapes the support for democracy? So here again, we are looking for a causal link. And it's not so easy to find an exogenous experiment like the German reunification. So what we do here is we build on this concept of a democratic capital stock on the individual level. So democratic capital stock means that the longer I have lived under democracy, the higher is my democratic capital stock, because the more experience I have accumulated with democracy. And since there we have almost 200 countries worldwide, or not 200 really, like 130 or so, you really get a lot of differences in this individual democratic capital stock across countries, especially given that many countries have a very varied experience in the recent years, so having several transitions between autocracy and democracy. And within a country, you get also differences by age groups. So especially in countries that haven't been democratic for a long time, or maybe have been democratic and then have gone back to autocracy, you find a different democratic capital stock for young and for old people. So we exploit these differences. So the longer an individual has lived under democracy and the more experience the individual has had with democracy, the stronger is the support for democracy.
Now, your work around German reunification is an example of how you have used natural experiments in macroeconomics to establish this causality. Mm-hmm. Are there any other examples of this work that you'd pick out?
The natural experiment I have worked with is the German reunification, which is a very nice natural experiment. I mean, so in general, economists often envy the natural scientists who can actually run experiments in a lab. And part of economics has used field and lab experiments quite extensively, especially in labor economics or in development economics. But we can still recur to natural experiments, which are these unplanned situations that fulfill the requirements for an experiment, namely that you have a random treatment. So in German reunification, as I argued, this is the case because this living in East Germany was exogenously imposed on the population, and it was a strong treatment of 45 years. So now we can analyze what happens after reunification. And another line of research in which I use this natural experiment is the research where I look at the saving behavior of people. In the life cycle hypothesis of consumption, we economists assume that people are forward-looking when making their consumption and savings decision, and they take income expectation and income risk into account. And testing this life cycle theory of consumption is usually done by comparing life cycle profiles of consumption in the data with a profile that a model would generate. But then it's sometimes hard to distinguish between different saving motives. So for example, the typical change in family size, which first increases over the life cycle and then typically decreases, can generate a hump in consumption over the life cycle. But that could also be generated by the precautionary savings motive, which says that people save in order to have some resources for unexpected shocks that could happen. And that would also predict that when you're young, you don't consume a lot because you want to save in order to build a buffer stock of wealth. And then when you get older, you start drawing down this buffer stock. Okay, so in German reunification, that was a very nice episode because we had a huge income shock to a big population. So there were 17 million East Germans, and now suddenly their predicted income growth increased substantially. But at the same time, their income risk also went up substantially, because in East Germany, you basically had no unemployment. There was not much variation in wages. So the income risk was very muted. But now in the West German system, obviously, you have substantially more income risk. So I use this to first see how do saving rates of East Germans look in the data, and then ask what would our model predict. And what I find is that the saving behavior of East Germans is very much in line with the model prediction of the life cycle hypothesis of consumption. So they are, right after reunification, they have higher saving rates than West Germans. And then over the first decade after unification, their saving rates decreased to the one of West Germans. And that is actually very much in line with the predictions of the precautionary saving motive, because now suddenly these households face substantial income risk, but they don't have a buffer stock of wealth, so they basically had no wealth holdings at reunification. So they really save a lot in the first years in order to build up at least a small buffer to insure against shocks.
Compared to your colleagues in microeconomics who can create an experiment to measure effects like this, when you are looking for a natural experiment, you have to wait for one to occur. Are there enough natural experiments around and we just have to look harder for them?
Well, yeah, there aren't that many, and it's actually hard to look for them, so that is true. So if you find one, like I found the German unification, you can use it often for different kind of questions. Other than that, experiments that can often be used for macroeconomists are big changes in government policies. The Bush tax rebates are also an experiment that economists analyze and ask how do people react to the receipt of a check that came with this tax rebate. There were similar programs now in the Great Recession where there was a huge disbursement of government expenditures to households. What is always the most tricky part and what we as researchers have to be most careful about is to make sure that we really exploit exogenous variation there, so that the variation that we find, for example, across households in the amount they receive is not caused by the economic conditions of this household or of the regions in which they live. But fortunately, every now and then there are experiments that we can use.
Nicola Fuchs-Schundeln, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim.
I have been speaking to Nicola Fuchs-Schundeln of Goethe University Frankfurt, a CEPR fellow and one of the winners of the 2018 Leibniz Prize. This has been a Vox Talk, presented by the Centre for Economic Policy Research. For more in the series, visit voxeu.org/vox-talks.